Still, there have been instances where 30-year-old bulbs bloomed too. Around the world, saffron is used as food seasoning, medicine, dyeing agent, and fragrance. At the moment, Iran is the world's biggest producer of saffron, accounting for 90% of the world's production. Saffron has been used as a coloring agent for 50,000 years. Signs of that application have been discovered in drawings found in caves in Iraq and across the Achaemenid Persian Empire. Sumerians used it as medicine and for making certain potions. Iran's South Khorasan province is the main producer of saffron in the country. The reason I've chosen Isfandiyar is the many other stunning sights to see apart from the beautiful saffron farms, the beautiful pomegranate, fig, and almond gardens. The lofty mountains behind the village reaching to the skies, the vast terraced saffron farms, and the very hospitable people who are a valuable asset for Iran. Add to that the beautiful ancient village of Isfandiyar that has lain uninhabited for around 30 years for fear of earthquakes. Beauties have turned Isfandiyar into a peerless little paradise in the heart of the desert. I'm overjoyed at the knowledge that the village has maintained its original shape, everything from the architecture to the farmlands. Thanks to my good friend Abbas Amiri, a village council member and a schoolteacher, and the other responsible inhabitants of the village, no one is allowed to make even the smallest changes to the architecture of the buildings in the village and of those nearby. I hope that the authorities of the Cultural Heritage Organization and the responsible villagers living here will join forces in preserving and renovating the unique architecture of the buildings in Isfandiyar, give local and foreign tourists a chance to relish in such a beautiful bucolic environment, and leave a precious legacy for posterity. Additionally, a move like that will help the country's tourism industry to thrive and create jobs for the locals, provided that not a single modern structure is built in this area and the landscape is clear of paved roads, power posts, and other eyesores. I spend the whole day walking around in the mountains surrounding Isfandiyar and taking beautiful photos of the village from different angles. I'm supposed to accompany my good friend Amir, a village council member and high school teacher, and his kindly wife to a saffron farm. I want to see up close how they and other villagers pick the saffron threads. It's freezing. It's 6:30 in the morning and most of the villagers have already sat down in a squatting position on their farms picking saffron-bearing flowers. I really didn't want to get out of my comfortable bed and come out here in this biting cold and dry weather. But the best time to pick those flowers and to see the farmers at work is the very early cold hours of morning. Apparently, it has to be cold, and it should still be dark when they start picking the flowers. I better get going. Very cold, very. It is mid-fall and the best time to harvest the saffron. The cold early morning fall weather in the desert is ice cold. Time is of the essence for these saffron farmers, so they have to make the best use of the time they have. From the day when the first saffron crocuses burst into flower, the farmers have around 15 days to pick all of them. Therefore, they cannot wake up anytime they want and go to work anytime they please. There is a certain time during all those 15 days at which the farmers can pick the flowers, and that is only the early morning hours. All the villagers, men and women, young and old, lend a helping hand on the farm during this period. It takes a certain degree of skill to pick the flowers, and the older folks of Esfandiar are master pickers, hands down. If you leave those flowers under the sun for too long after they have bloomed, your saffron is going to lose most of its original aroma and taste. It diminishes the quality of your saffron, as if the aroma of the saffron gets released into the air and disappears forever. That's what I'm told. You have to pick the buds with the longest stems, and you have to do it fast. There is no alternative to the human hand when it comes to picking these flowers. No machines, no automatons, no nothing. The men and women of the village spend hours squatting or doubling down while picking the flowers. The cold weather and the time crunch on the one hand, and the pressure on the farmers' knees and backs on the other, make the job ever more difficult. The tips of the fingers tingle from the bitter cold, and nagging pain starts to be felt in the knees and back. The work is agonizing and toilsome. Desert dwellers are tough human beings, and do not easily give up in the face of the difficulties presented to them by life. These people's entire being is made up of hope and love of life. They are eternally grateful to God, even when doing the most difficult of work. The young people, too, hum local songs as they work. After spending only a couple of hours with Amir and his family on their farm, I'm completely worn out. The pain in my back and knees is excruciating, but I feel great, because during those 3 hours, I got to see firsthand what these hard-working people go through. I can feel their pain. But there's something that upsets me and all of Iran's saffron farmers. Unfortunately, the farmers do the lion's share of the work in producing saffron. A case in point is the back-breaking harvesting process, but it's the middleman who stands to make most of the profit. That's an issue that calls for proper management and careful planning. The farmers need help to cash in on the result of their hard work, to make a profit that makes it all worth their while. Another big problem is a lack of proper, internationally interesting packaging industry in Iran for exporting saffron. A country like Spain is making the best of this opportunity. It buys Iran's high-quality saffron at a very low price, puts it in beautiful, modern packaging, and re-exports it to other countries in its own name and at a much higher price. The margin of profit is staggering, and that's what the farmers here have been complaining about. I am depressed after watching the farmers work so hard and hearing out their problems. But Amir has a present for me to cheer me up. To refresh themselves and shake off the cold after the working hours, the farmers get together somewhere next to their farms and brew themselves some fresh tea laced with fresh saffron in a pot on fire made from dry sticks. Thank you. locals here believe that saffron tea cheers you up. It makes you laugh. It helps freshen you up. But for someone like me, the question that comes to mind is, how can you not be happy when you hang around with such hardworking, kind, pure souls? How can you sit down with these folks, sip saffron tea with them, and not be filled with joy? The fact is that even without this tea, saffron tea I mean, you get filled with peace and happiness when you hang around with people who spend all day from morning till evening doing back-breaking work. Cheers. After imbibing that delicious saffron-flavored tea one sip at a time, I decide to sit down with one of the elders of Isfandiyar, and that is none other than Mr. Danai. He tells me about the desert people's frugal existence, about their simple lifestyle, about the tough days of famine many years ago, and the perseverance and resilience of his fellow villagers in the face of the vicissitudes of life. The farmers don't have any time to waste. Therefore, after picking the flowers, they usually sit down together and start the next phase of saffron production, which is plucking the stigmas from the flowers. That's why I believe those who live in deserts or near them are very patient people. See for yourself. Take a look around. It took a lot of patience for them to turn this steep surface into a terraced farmland. Then, with a lot of hardship, they planted the saffron bulbs in it, spent months attending to them and waiting for them to yield. As far as I know, saffron crocuses bloom once a year. It takes a lot of elbow grease to cultivate them. They don't need much water, but still growing them is no walk in the park. Everything about saffron requires a lot of hard work and patience. That's why I've come to believe that desert dwellers are very stoic. Whatever they do calls for a lot of patience, and if they aren't patient, things won't happen. They won't prosper. The pain Mr. Amiri has in his knees and back is a pain that everybody here shares. All these people work really hard on these farms. And as I say, those living in desert climates are super patient human beings. Being in their company gives you the kind of peace that defies description. The last stage in the production of saffron involves spreading the stigmas on a proper surface and leaving them to dry. And that's a job that has to be done with a lot of care and skill. Otherwise, quality of the end product will be impacted. In the end, the middlemen come to the villages, buy the dried saffron from the farmers, and sell it at staggering prices after proper packaging. I have high hopes for this beautiful village to be reconstructed and renovated. I hope that on my next trip to Isfandiyar, I see many tourists here. There aren't many places on Earth that share the same natural, architectural, agricultural, and anthropological variety as Isfandiyar's. But unfortunately, those beautiful houses you see behind me, although they used to be people's homes one day, now lay in ruins. No one is paying adequate attention to all the historical, cultural, and architectural beauties of our beloved country. I'm sure each one of those houses in this beautiful mountainous region, with all these vast terraced saffron farms and its beautiful gardens, not to mention its very hospitable residents, I'm sure if they are renovated, they can act as hotels in this region to accommodate tourists coming from other countries and, of course, local tourists traveling to this region. They can become beautiful hotels offering peaceful moments to those staying at them. My trip to South Khorasan has come to an end. I'm leaving with beautiful memories and valuable knowledge of this region of Iran. Before setting out for this part of the country from the capital city, I wouldn't even dream of such spectacular scenery and such kind human beings. I traveled to this area to see the saffron crocuses growing in the desert. I found the beauties of South Khorasan as a treasure trove, each of which is as beautiful as Iran's famed saffron. All this area needs to turn it into a major tourist attraction is proper attention and management on the part of government officials. And all that is possible If the traditional lifestyle of the folks living here does not undergo any radical changes, and provided the untouched scenery in these areas is not despoiled by modern residential and industrial structures. The beautiful face of deserts and the wilderness, the sand dunes and mountains, the animal and plant species living in deserts, an unpolluted blue sky, clean air, beautiful, vacant yet livable villages, the farms and gardens of the area, and on top of them all, the genuine and hospitable people with a rich culture. Each and every one of them is as precious as the saffron produced in the desert of South Khorasan. All I wish for is for all these assets to be preserved and protected for future generations.
Perhaps next time you'll enjoy another Persian dish with the exquisite scent of saffron, you will remember the terraced saffron farms of Isfandiyar and the kind and hard-working farmers who plant the little purple flowers and harvest strands of red gold. And that's it for this week. Do join me again next time here on Aperture for another documentary. But before we go, remember you can contact us either through email, Facebook, or Twitter. Goodbye for now.
A letter for you.
And this is a letter written by the leader of the Muslim Ummah.
Special program on the message of Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei to the youth in Europe and North America.
Open the windows! Let the world hear!
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners.
My name is Muzaffar Abbas Haider.
I am Mirza Rezavi.
And I am Brother Ali Shah.
And we're here to bring you a letter for you. A recent letter from Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader of Iran, has left the West tapping their toes in confusion. The point is that the West is very, very confused about what's happened. You see, the letter is a baffling notion for the West. Why, Irtiza?
Because first of all, it's from an Eastern leader, specifically a Muslim leader.
Mm-hmm.
Thirdly, an Iranian leader.
Mm-hmm.
So like, I mean, I don't really need to explain why it's baffling.
The name of what, Brother Irtiza?
He is the supreme leader of Iran, which is Ayatollah Khamenei. He is the successor to Ayatollah Khomeini, who brought the Islamic Revolution in Iran, just, I'm guessing, about 35, 36 years ago.
That's right. And in this letter, Ayatollah Khamenei is basically telling the West of the youth. That's right. This letter is addressed exclusively to you. And if there are anybody older listening, I'm sorry, but it's not exactly for you. But you can read it too, which is a great thing. Now, the letter is telling the people of the West, the youths of the West, to wake up, to start looking around, to start researching, to start understanding what Islam is from its core, which of course is the Holy Quran and the Hadith, and not just from the mainstream media. Why is it a baffling notion, Irtiza, for Western people to see an Eastern leader telling the people to think?
It's a baffling thing because the Eastern leader...
Brother, you cannot use words like baffling, what it means.
I'm sure well, they know what baffling means.
Well, let's just say that, Ali, you are quite baffled at the word baffled.
I'm not baffled, bro.
You know what it means?
Yeah.
What does it mean?
Baffled means when you are really...
When you're confused.
Confused.
Ali, do you know what? You can go and look at a dictionary later on after the show.
Okay.
Irtiza.
Okay. Back to the main topic. What was the question you asked again? Sorry?
Why is it confusing for the West to see an Eastern leader?
It's an Eastern leader. He's not from the West.
Mm-hmm.
West... generally, I'm giving a generalization, it's more open-minded.
People
more
associate the West with being open-minded.
Like, yeah, people associate the West of being open-minded, forward-thinking, more scientifically, like, shrewd and strong. This is from the East. This come out from East, from Iran. From Iran, which is a very, which is a country that's very hot in the news for the, I would say since the revolution, since the Islamic revolution came to Iran, it's been very hot in the news. It's been a very big subject about sanctions, nuclear power, whatever, and so forth. However, this is a letter from the Iranian leader, the supreme leader Ayatollah Khamenei, addressing the youth of the West, specifically to use their own mind, be free, and make their own decisions, and basically think for themselves. Yeah. Like, for instance, they have around them a whole array of news outlets coming from the East and the West, right, and the North and wherever, saying, this is Islam, this isn't Islam, this is the way it is, this is the war on terror, this is what we're promising, against terrorism, Muslims are terrorists, so on and so forth. That it's some people would argue that it's even gone towards Islamophobia. Right. So this is basically the supreme leader of Iran saying to the students, I'm guessing students and youth, that think for yourself, don't follow, like, listen to your elders, respect your elders, but don't follow them blindly.
Yeah. I mean, he does in the letter use words like understand, think, research, investigate.
Yeah,
it's not
exactly
really things that you'd expect to hear from a Middle Eastern leader. Going back to what you said about Islamophobia, I'd like to focus on that today, inshallah. Now, Islamophobia in the West, first of all, let's look at the word Islamophobia. What does Islamophobia actually mean? This is where we go to our brother Ali. Ali, would you please care to explain to us the word Islamophobia?
Like, you know the word phobia? It means like
fear.
When you're going against something, like Islamophobia is like...
The word phobia means fear. Fear,
yeah, fear, like in a way, like it gives a lot of fear in that community.
Mm-hmm.
So what they mean by Islamophobia is they're fearing Islam.
A fear of Islam,
yeah.
That's pretty much what it means. Would
so
you say, I mean, you're from Scotland.
Yes.
Now, back in Scotland, would you describe the sort of impression that people have in the north of Britain as fear? Like, what they think of the Muslims as fear?
I think most of the people back home in the UK, not only Scotland, I think everywhere, they fear Islam. Like, if there's a guy who is a Muslim, they will think he's a terrorist, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Or they will avoid him.
Uh-huh.
If there's a man, he's a Christian or a Catholic or a Jewish person, they would have more trust in him than a Muslim. Even if, imagine now, I went for a job interview and I am really clever, I have all the degrees, I have all the knowledge, but then there's a man who's a Jewish or a Christian.
Or even an atheist.
He will be chosen before me.
It's
because,
sorry if I could say,
they do not trust Muslims. Yeah. They have no trust in the Muslims. They believe that we only bring terror. We have no love. Because when they open the Quran, if, for example, if you give a person in another faith the Quran, the first part he is going to read is kill the disbelievers.
It's a quote which is handed out quite a bit.
Yeah,
in regards
now
to
they
the Quran.
Believe that we are the religion of terror and violence.
Irtaza, do you agree with this?
To be honest, I'd like to interject and basically say, is that more of a stereotype? That, like, for instance, I agree, yes, to a degree that Muslims have been under the backlash. Like how we discussed earlier, nearly through every period of time, there's been groups of people who have been persecuted. Like, for instance, the Jews have been persecuted. Black people have been persecuted during the slavery and everything. Red Indians, Native Indians, Aborigines, everyone's been, like, to an extent, oppressed and persecuted. Is this, like, does this hold some truth, but we're just kind of using it and saying, oh, when I go for a job interview, it's because I'm Muslim, they don't allow me.
Uh-huh.
Is it like that, or, like, is it really more than that? Because, like, as far as I've understood, Islamophobia is that exists amongst ignorant people, to be honest. If that's not a, like, I don't want to come too harsh, but amongst intellectuals,
to be honest with you, even the people that seem to be really nice to the Muslims, in their heart or somewhere in their mind, they hate us. You know?
Going back to what Hitler said,
very
about
strong words.
Brother Muzaff,
yeah,
one point I would like to make is that people see the religion of Islam as a really, like, fair religion. They think all we care about is killing people, terror, no love, no peace. And because of this matter is spreading through the whole nation now. Everyone is thinking Islam is wrong.
It can be very easily argued that when you turn on the news, what do you see? I mean, pre 9/11, basically, before 9/11, mm-hmm. I remember going to school. I remember going in daily life back in London. And to be honest, everything was so normal, so peaceful.
This is before 2001?
Before 9/11.
Before 9/11, 2001.
I didn't experience any hostility, nothing, to be honest with you. Okay, every now and then
I'll have to agree with you. Everything was nice.
Someone would turn around and be like, oh yeah, Paki, this and that, you're brown or whatever.
Yeah.
But it wasn't any, like, real...
There was no hostility.
Real hostility.
When I used to go to school before the 9/11, people used to say to me, you're a curry muncher.
Curry muncher, but that's different to your religion.
Racism is different to religion.
Like, that's a completely different story that, to be honest, through every time and every place as it has existed.
The thing about Islamophobia is it can target a black person, a white person, a Chinese person, if they've got a big beard and if they're wearing a hat.
Now,
going back to the letter for a moment, it says, Ayatollah Khamenei is saying, I would like to talk to you, i.e. the youth, about Islam, particularly the image that is presented to you as Islam. He says that many attempts have been made over the past two decades, almost since the disintegration of the Soviet Union, to place this great religion in the seat of a horrifying enemy. Is this something you'd agree with?
Yeah, in my opinion, yeah. I would agree with that 100%, to be honest, that since, well, I wasn't there since in the Soviet Union time, but like I said, after 9/11, and if you look through history, That is almost a very exact presentation of what is happening to Islam at the moment. Like, for instance, the most funniest thing out of all is that most of this depiction is coming out from, like, Saudi rulership, Saudi infiltration. Uh-huh. If you look towards, like, Africa and this stuff, it was completely peaceful until the Saudi version of Islam reached there. Same with the West.
Uh-huh.
Like, when the Saudi version of Islam reached there... Like,
what do you mean by the Saudi version of Islam?
This is amongst most Muslims. Like,
you're talking about very right-wing Islam.
Very right-wing, like, for instance...
the people who believe that, for example... Wahhabism.
Wahhabism, yeah. They believe that the Shias worship graves.
Uh-huh.
They do not worship Allah. Uh-huh.
Not just
their views against us are really, really horrific as well.
Not just Shias, I would just like to point... Their view against everybody... Everybody, like, forget
well,
about.
I
Shias.
Think they're
like,
okay. Like Wahhabism are okay with Christians. They're okay. With Americans, with like even Catholics, Christians. They have a big problem against the Shias.
They have a really big problem with Shias because that's within Islam itself. But the Wahhabi actually school of thought itself, like, it's very contradicting to itself. Like, some stuff they say, their books are completely against. But anyway, that's a completely different topic to get into.
Yeah, that's true.
But
now this right wing ideology of Islam, which is very. I don't want to use the word extremist, but I guess that is what it is. It's taking one fundamental principle of Islam and it's taking it to its extreme while disregarding everything else. Like, they're the types of Muslims that you'd see making blanket statements. They're the types of Muslims that you'd see cutting people's heads off. The types of Muslims that you'd see even blowing themselves up.
Mm-hmm.
Now, would you say that this Islamophobia, which is spreading, is solely due to these types of right-wing Muslims?
I would say... they fuel the fire, but solely to say, even though I love the media has a hell of a lot to play in this assault. Like, for instance, a simple example: somebody gets stabbed in London. They're not going to turn around and be like, youth did a stabbing over whatever. However, if it's a Muslim youth, they'll be like, a Muslim youth of 22 years old in a gang fight stabbed someone. It's like, what happened to, like, if it was someone, some normal youth, you'd just be like, a youth stabbed someone in a gang fight.
Yeah.
But when it comes to a Muslim youth, Muhammad ibn something, 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 stabbed him in a gang fight. I don't see the correlation.
I can completely agree. I mean, who was that psychopath who went around killing people in somewhere in Europe?
Breivik, the guy with blonde hair. He was actually a Christian.
He was a
But that was never plastered around.
Do you know, he actually made a book... with a whole manifesto in it. It had the crucifix at the
really?
On the front page.
Really?
It was a thick book about how he wants to, you know, evangelize America, how he wants to evangelize the West, how he wants to evangelize Europe.
Like a mini crusade.
A mini crusade.
Yeah.
Now,
it's all
when the media looks at this character, they never, ever point the finger at Christianity.
No.
This is something that we always know. Now, would you say that the right-wing Muslims within the Ummah, would you say that they exist because they've taken certain verses of the Quran out of context?
To be honest, this is a very deep thing. Like, for instance, there's conspiracy theories about this, there's some truth about it, mm-hmm. some like flesh to the bone, where these people are unfortunately misguided mm-hmm. because of their teachers, but unfortunately their teachers have some type of link to yeah. dirty politics,
yeah.
like Saudi politics with money. Or it really has nothing to do with religion. It's all about money. Uh-huh. It's all about the money. It comes from there. It comes from there. But then it stems off. Like when it gets into these people's minds, then it's like a plague. To be honest, I can't put it any other way. It's like a plague. It starts from someone doing something stupid,
yeah.
like some dirty deal being done, like AIDS yeah. or something like that, uh-huh. and then it just continues and like spirals out of control. Uh-huh. And then due to this assault that is also being flung upon the Muslims, this makes them even more radical. They're like, everyone hates us anyway.
I think that has to be dissected very deeply. What you brothers have said is correct, but we will have to go more deeply and research more, and then we will continue, inshallah.
I completely agree with you. I think it's a lot more that we need to discuss in order to actually get to the bottom of this. Just going back to the verse which you quoted, which is often thrown around, it's actually chapter 2, verse 191
okay.
of the Holy Quran. It says, "And kill them wherever you find them, and drive them out from whence they drove you out, and persecution is severer than slaughter. And do not fight them at the sacred mosque until they fight with you in it. But if they do fight you, then slay them. Such is the recompense of the unbelievers."
No, brother, I have one point to make.
Mm-hmm.
Many people give the Quran to the non-believers as a gift when they have never, ever read the Quran themselves properly. So if you give a Quran to your friend, a non-believer, and the first page he opens, just imagine he comes to that page.
Uh-huh.
And it's like, kill the believers, disbelievers.
You see, the thing is,
so then why is he going to think in his mind that Islam...
No, I completely agree with you, but the thing about
that's
this
taken
is...
taken out of context. You have to also remember that.
Like, this verse is focused on, and usually, to be honest, it's always the first line of this verse, and kill them wherever you find them, and they don't read the rest of the verse, nor do they read the verse before it and after it. The verse before it says, "And fight in the way of Allah with those who fight with you, and do not exceed the limits. Surely Allah does not love those who exceed the limits." The verse straight after that says, "But if they desist, then surely Allah is forgiving, merciful." Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, do remember to never take things out of context. And when we're actually showing people what Islam is, it's important to give them a holistic view of Islam and not just a one-sided view. I think that's where the main problem has come from. And it's fueled this Islamophobia, which, inshallah, we will talk about more in the next episode. From myself, Muzaffar Abbas Haider.
From me, Irtaza Rezavi.
And from me, your loving brother, Alisha.
We hope that you have enjoyed listening, and inshallah, we look forward to seeing you next time. Assalamu alaikum.
A letter for you.
And this is a letter written by the leader of the Muslim Ummah.
Special program on the message of Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei to the youth in Europe and North America.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This
for
is
a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين. وصلى الله على محمد وآله الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to For a Better Life with me, Javed Akbari. We are going to discuss an important question in this episode, and that is, what is the philosophy behind the bitter and horrific events? Of course, each one of us might have come across such events. We may have experienced pain, we may have experienced bitter and horrific incidents in our life, not only every individual but also their families, their relatives might have witnessed such incidents in other people's lives also. To begin with, I would say that horrific and bitter events that occur in our lives are of two kinds: those that emanate from our own actions. We are ourselves responsible because of our deeds, because of our actions, and because of the decisions that we make in our life. So we are directly responsible for those actions. And of course, those that are beyond our control, there are some incidents taking place in our life that we have nothing and no means to control. Of course, they fall beyond our control. Like, for example, floods are there, you see, earthquakes are there, cyclones are there, and these are the things which we have nothing to say about. Of course, we have no say in them. So they are beyond our control. Many terrible events occur because of a lack of prudence and proper management, that is for sure. If, for example, during a transaction we fail to maintain documentation and the other party, for example, fails to deliver the money, it is our fault. If we do not build a safety fence around a swimming pool and a child drowns in it, it is our fault, you know. If we do not practice good hygiene, if we do not obey road laws and follow special etiquettes, it's our fault. If we fall ill, have car accidents, or are humiliated in society, the fault lies with us. So these are some examples of the bitter events and horrific events that take place in our life when we ourselves are, for example, involved and guilty, and we are blameworthy, because it is that through our actions that we cause such bitter incidents in our life. For example, a driver who is reckless, who is careless, he weaves through traffic, he does not pay attention to the road, or maybe he cuts other people off, or maybe he does not pay attention to the traffic signal, and he causes an accident, or he is responsible for a fatal accident. He is to blame, not God. Or, for example, when someone conducts a transaction and he does not maintain documentation. For example, God in the Holy Quran says, "Wa zatadayantum bidainin." When you want to, carry out a transaction, then of course you have to present witnesses, or you have to call someone to bear witness. But we do not do this, and we try to trust the other person, and at the end of the day, that person betrays you. That person betrays us. So we are responsible, because at the end of the day, we do not have any document, any evidence, any piece of evidence to prove to the court and to establish our case or to win the case. That is our fault. And if we fall ill, it is because we do not observe the hygiene, or we do not take care of hygiene. If we, let's say, catch virus, especially in these days, when we have this COVID-19, this global pandemic, we are not only risking our life, we are not causing only putting ourselves in danger, but also endanger the lives of other people. So we should be, and we are to blame.
Shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
The second type of the horrific events, or the horrific and bitter events and incidents, pain, struggle, hardship are the keys to success in life. In order to advance, develop, grow, and overcome the difficulties of life, one must endure hardships. You know, hardships make us more adamant, more powerful to tackle, to appreciate the blessings of Allah, and to understand God's blessings. The difficulties, hardships, and trials and tribulations in life can be the atonement of our slip-ups, our mistakes, and our errors. And they can help people adjust themselves to different settings, to different situations. The Prophet, peace be upon him and his family, said, لَوْلَا ثَلَاثَةٌ فِي إِبْنِ آدَمْ مَا تَعْتَى رَسَهُ شَيْءٌ الْمَرَضُ وَالْمَوْتُ وَالْفَقْرُ. Were it not for three things, the son of Adam would not bow his head: death, illness, and poverty. So Adam would be ignorant, the son of Adam would remain ignorant, stubborn, and he would not bow his head, except that death, illness, and poverty make him actually bow his head. So this hadith actually suggests that hardships, bitter experiences, and tragic events, they are a blessing in disguise. For example, if there is flood, if there is a deluge, and if there is a heavy rainfall causing the roads to flood, okay? Apparently, it seems to be a kind of tragic incident. It seems to be a source of, or a cause of inconvenience, but it is not a cause of inconvenience. It's not something to be unhappy about, you know, because at the end of the day, we will have enough water to irrigate our lands, we will have enough water to drink, and we will have enough lands to cultivate. So this is the blessings. We think because it hurts us, it is a cause of inconvenience, it's going to be a cause of inconvenience for others as well. But that's not the case. Problems and difficulties help one to perfect himself. He who is afflicted with a calamity can grow and develop through patience and endurance. And he who is at ease and struggles to save others can grow and develop through sacrifice and dedication. That's all for this session. Inshallah, we will discuss the issue and this very topic further in the following episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Your mercy, your love is all I need.
Your love is all I need.
All I need.
Your love is all I need.
It's all I need.
Your love is all I need.
All I need.
Your love is all I need. All I need to be all so I can be, and I know that you see how much you mean to me. Cause your love is all I need to be all I can be, and I know that you see how much you mean to me. Cause your love is all I need.
Your love is all I need.
The end of the Cold War came as a huge relief to the people of the world, who felt that the bipolar world order tension had finally ended, and the world could settle down and live in peace. However, it seems that the Western powers still needed a scapegoat to target, and hence the birth of Islamophobia was commenced, and in the process, the Western media created a new enemy. Yet in 2015, following a spate of numerous events around the world, the leader of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, wrote a letter to the youth of the Western world asking them to ignore the media and reconsider the image of Islam. But it seems that the leader's message of 6 years ago is still very much valid today, as his words are well reflected in the ongoing spreading of fear and the spreading of hatred demonstrated by Western leaders towards Islam and Muslims in general. One only has to look at the far-right ideologies of ex-US President Donald Trump, who during his tenure instigated one of the most controversial and discriminatory laws ever passed when he executed his so-called travel ban on countries with a majority Muslim population. Although it was not Trump who started Islamophobia, he certainly added fuel to the fire through his words and actions.
I'm here to protest Donald Trump's racist, xenophobic immigration order, which is against everything that America is about and against everything I stand for as a human.
Yet the leader of the Islamic Revolution raised a very valid point 6 years ago, and is one that stands true more than ever today as technology advances and has encouraged the youth of the world to break down the barriers fabricated across the globe and use the tools and resources so readily available to educate themselves about the truth, hence exposing the lies and deceit created and encouraged by the likes of Donald Trump al. When it comes to Islam. With some people being led to believe that Islam is the world enemy, so many fail to see the consequences of Western actions, either directly or indirectly against Islam and Muslims, hence proving that back in 2015, the leader knew that the time had come for enlightenment, and as the message stands as strong as ever today, sadly, the youth of the West are still falling to the influence of negative images, catalyzed and sparked by real extremists around the world, whose sole aim is to create division and tension between mankind. When the French satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo published offensive pictures of the Prophet Muhammad, the Muslim world reacted with anger, stating that the line between freedom of speech and respect for religion and faith had been breached, and saw the resulting attack on the HQ of Charlie Hebdo condemned by the world over, including Muslims, who were horrified by the extremist reaction. Yet the republication of the cartoons, as well as the rise of the far right that stemmed from the events, have seen a huge rise of Islamophobia in France, and is something that's almost been encouraged by French leaders who have failed to condemn the actions taken under the so-called pretext of free speech. Yet it seems that time is not a healer when it comes to such acts, as the rise of Islamophobia begins to gather pace across Europe, in part assisted by the French, exporting their model of Islamophobia across the continent, according to the international head of CAGE, an NGO based in the UK that fights against the discrimination against Muslims. Although the world is currently distracted by events such as the COVID-19 pandemic and various social political events around the world, some have taken a stance against the ongoing phenomenon of Islamophobia, making sure the problem is brought to the attention of the highest authorities. It's hence why some 36 NGOs from across 13 nations around the world have sought intervention by the United Nations to tackle the problem from the top, encouraging world leaders to take a stance against Islamophobia as they would any other form of discrimination or hate. What now remains to be seen is whether a change of president in the US and the lifting of the so-called travel ban will start a new era in the world order and encourage other world leaders and the youth of the West to take a new look at Islam and finally understand that hatred being spread by a small minority should once and forever remain a thing of the past.
Former U.S. President Donald Trump took full advantage of his last hours in office this week to push through a flurry of controversial decisions. One of Trump's final acts was signing a deal to sell state-of-the-art warplanes and drones to the United Arab Emirates. His administration reportedly signed the deal just 1 hour before Trump's tumultuous presidential term was over. Under the agreement, the UAE is expected to receive 50 stealth F-35 warplanes and 18 advanced Reaper drones. The Emiratis have long expressed interest in getting the stealth jets. The UAE was promised a chance to purchase them when it agreed to normalize relations with Israel last August, angering the Palestinians. the arms deal was pushed by the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, who was central to the normalization of ties with Israel. The weapons package is considered another part of Trump's notorious dealings with Persian Gulf Arab allies, which have long records of human rights violations. The Emiratis, for instance, have been deeply involved in the devastating Saudi-led war on Yemen, which has triggered the world's worst humanitarian disaster. The UAE has carried out a large number of aerial bombardments in Yemen, where hospitals, schools, weddings, and funerals have been among the targets on the ground. The business-minded former U.S. president boosted weapons transfers to its regional allies despite outcry by human rights advocates. A coalition of human rights organizations recently urged the U.S. to avoid further arms sales to the United Arab Emirates. The rights groups believe more arms for the Emiratis would worsen a set of bloody conflicts in Yemen, Libya, and beyond. Former U.S. President Donald Trump was dismissive of such warnings. The United States itself has been deeply involved in the Yemen war ever since it began in 2015. The U.S. military support for the Saudis and their Emirati allies has included mid-air refueling, providing intelligence and logistics. During his presidential campaign, the new U.S. president signaled a major shift. He has pledged to take a tough line on human rights issues, even when it comes to America's allies. Biden has also hinted at ending weapons transfers and military support to the Saudi-led coalition pounding Yemen. But critics say actions speak louder than words. They say there is no guarantee that Biden will change America's approach as he promised. Saudi and Emirati petrodollars have proved irresistible to many American presidents. Is Joe Biden really willing to put human rights first and change America's stance in the region?
I don't think any American government, any American president is going to step completely away from the petrodollars coming into the American defense industry. However, I think everyone has to realize in Washington and elsewhere is that this war, I hate to keep harping on American national security, but what does it have to do with American national security?
How will he deal with powerful Saudi and Emirati lobbies in Washington? Biden faces tough choices over Yemen and his ties with the regimes of Saudi Arabia and UAE, as he will probably need to make very important decisions soon.
The British military complex is a shadow of its former empirical past, plagued by huge budget deficits, deteriorating equipment, and a very demoralized group of staff. Therefore, in order to bolster the bank balance, the British have leaned on their experience in the service sector and have turned their military into a training facilitator for paying customers. Following a Freedom of Information request by an anti-arms sales group, it's become apparent that the UK military has recently been responsible for training foreign military forces from over 150 countries around the world, equating to some two-thirds of the global countries, and has included tasks from battle training to military band practice. Whereas this could be seen as a sensible way of making money, the reality is that some 15 of the countries who have paid for the training have been rebuked by the British authorities for violations of human rights abuses, raising the question as to just how serious the British are when it comes to human rights and why they would agree to train such countries.
This is a difficult situation, and the opposition parties in Parliament have raised the question. The campaigning organisation at the centre of the current story, the Campaign Against the Arms Trade, has tried through the courts to bring into force a more coherent British ethical foreign policy. But that has not happened so far, and the Ministry of Defence considers that its relationships, particularly with certain Gulf monarchies, is very strong and important for Britain, and therefore it is basically giving them a green card to go ahead with do what they want.
Media spokesman for the Campaign Against the Arms Trade, Andrew Smith, was quoted as saying that the Act raises a very serious question for the British government, asking why they are so readily willing to support countries that apply repressive laws and have been accused of torture or have a known history of human rights violations. Yet the British government and military complex downplayed the allegations, stating that such cooperation was merely part of the statecraft designed to improve international diplomatic relations, claiming that all decisions are made on a country-by-country basis. Yet with the UK on its knees financially from the impact of Brexit and the COVID-19 pandemic, it seems that when it comes to income, one can turn a blind eye to certain events, as every little helps when it comes to earning money. When the former British Prime Minister Theresa May travelled to the Persian Gulf to meet the leaders of Bahrain, the sole intention of the visit was to represent and sell British-made weapons to the island, and is something that's emulated today with other such nations in the West Asia region. With Saudi Arabia also a loyal customer of Britain when it comes to the arms trade, it seems that money flowing in from the arms trade to Britain is enough to divert attention away from the repressive regimes that they sell to. In fact, the Saudi-led war on Yemen is a prime example of such oppression, with Saudi bombs killing over 100,000 people in the country, making up nearly half of the 233,000 people who have lost their lives as a direct or indirect result of the war on Yemen. With the supply of arms knowingly being sold to the Saudis to perform such actions, are then the British not an accomplice to the crimes being committed by Riyadh? And if so, should the UK not be sanctioned for their role in the deaths of so many innocent civilians?
Well, certainly there's been concern expressed about British training for sniper forces in Bahrain, given the efforts of Bahrain Defence Force against the Shia majority population in certain situations. And then, of course, British support through the arms trade for the Saudi-led coalition's efforts in the war in Yemen since 2015. So this is something which is certainly full of contradictions. And again, the opposition parties in Parliament have raised these questions, would like to see the policies changed. But at the moment, there is no chance of that happening so long as Boris Johnson and his Conservative ministers are in power.
Yet the truth of the matter is that Britain itself is guilty of human rights abuses and has been demonstrated throughout time, with atrocious allegations being made against British soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan, and of course a lot closer to home in the treatment of the people of the north of Ireland during the Troubles, which saw British soldiers committing acts that will long remain in the memories of the victims, hence proving that Britain has no moral values when it comes to certain issues.
The coronavirus pandemic, which resulted in prolonged lockdowns and tough preventive measures, has had an adverse effect on the global economy. Like any other crisis, countries responded differently to the COVID-19 outbreak, which determined the extent of their success in tackling the ill effects of the disease. Take China, for example, the world's second largest economy. It was bound to overtake the United States as the biggest economy in 2030. But according to economists, the Asian country is expected to pass the U.S. 2 years earlier, as its gross domestic product is forecast to expand by more than 8% this year alone.
I would think that the Chinese economy would overtake the U.S. economy before then, very shortly, because the Chinese government, under the leadership of President Xi Jinping, they're proceeding with a completely different economic political orientation. They see development of infrastructure and industry as primary. And of course, they've uplifted, removed from poverty, almost 800 million people, which is close to three times the size of the United States.
Moreover, China is the only major economy to have avoided contraction in 2020. This was despite an ongoing economic war between Washington and Beijing. U.S. President Donald Trump levied massive tariffs on Chinese imports to offset Beijing's trade surplus with Washington. But experts argue that the U.S. lackluster handling of the coronavirus ironically gave China the economic advantage. That begs the question, what would be the upcoming U.S. administration's response to this reality? And how is Washington going to adjust its policy toward its biggest competitor? Over the past 4 years, Donald Trump's America First policy took U.S. protectionism to a new level. Trump started trade wars with allies and foes alike, ripped up trade deals, and made attempts to play against international trade rules. In hindsight, those attempts, which were predominantly made to hinder China's economic growth, have proven counterproductive.